Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's afternoon satsang. Both Prem and I are aware that during our last satsang, we were contemplating on having a satsang this week on the concept of surrender. But then, surrender means allowing the Lord's will to, you know, take precedence over what you have decided. And I feel that is what has happened this week, because somehow both of us were inspired from within. Where else can you get inspired from? Mostly from within. And we feel that today is a very special day that should be dedicated to Lord Krishna. Even as we witness the wonderful celebrations in the morning at Sai Kulwant Hall on this glorious and holy occasion of Shri Krishna Janmashtami, it is only logical as well as inspirational to discuss on the life, message and the leelas of Bhagwan Shri Krishna. And so, this week, instead of surrender, the concept of surrender that we had promised, we will be taking up a theme from the life of Shri Krishna. And in order to delve into this beautiful theme and enjoy that, I would like to invite, as always, Brother Prem. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and definitely, how could we miss the opportunity of speaking on Lord Krishna when it's Janmashtami on a Thursday? Because very rarely we have a festival falling on Thursday, and whenever it has happened, we've tried to speak about the festival. And it just takes you back to so many times when Swami spoke about Lord Krishna. And I remember one of the Janmashtami discourses when Swami said, there is no other avatar, no other divine personage about whom just listening, reading and thinking can fill your mind with so much, bliss. Imagine Swami, we know that even thinking of Swami gives us so much happiness. Of course, Swami, we will not agree with that point. But Swami standing there and saying that, you know, we've all heard Swami speak so much about Lord Rama. We know that Swami's written two entire books about Lord Rama. But Swami makes this remark when he speaks about Krishna, because just that, just uttering that name kind of fills your heart with happiness. So definitely we couldn't miss this opportunity to talk about Krishna. But last time also, I think Janmashtami fell on a Thursday, and or around a Thursday, we took the opportunity to speak about Lord Krishna. We spoke about, I think, an interesting topic even then. Even now when I look back, I find it very interesting. We spoke about different pairs of devotees and how they were different, like Yashoda and Devaki, both mothers, but how their approach to Krishna was so different. And the other devotees like Arjuna and Yudhishthira, how they were both related to Krishna the same way, but how they were different. And Uddhava and Sudama, some pairs like that we have taken. How much we can learn about devotion to Krishna through the lives of these devotees.
And so this week, what we thought was, dear listeners, that if we look at the different avatars that Swami speaks about, I think Krishna will figure in the top over there. You know, so much has Swami spoken about Krishna. In fact, there have been summer courses that have been dedicated to Krishna and the Mahabharata. So in Krishna's life also, if we go through Swami's discourses, we will notice that Swami emphasizes and takes a lot of interest in certain episodes and certain aspects of Krishna's life, and maybe there are a handful, about 10 or a dozen of them. For example, Krishna's birth. I remember that beautiful thing how Swami says that even as Vasudeva picks up Lord Krishna to transport him to Nanda Gokula, the chains fall off, the prison doors open, the guards go to sleep, and then he goes and places Krishna there, and he comes back, and once he comes back, the guards wake up, the prison doors lock themselves again, he is back in chains. And Swami would say, this is what happens when you pick the Lord up, when you take up the Lord, you are liberated. All chains fall away and you are free. The moment you put down the Lord, you let go of Lord, then you are bound back in chains. What a beautiful message. So, Swami has spoken a lot about Krishna's birth, as to how when you are with the Lord, every obstacle becomes another example of his glory, how the waters of the river part and they become a miracle, an example of Lord Krishna's glory. instead of being an obstacle. I think it was Yamuna, right? Yamuna.
Right.
Yamuna river would have otherwise been an obstacle. It becomes a miracle. So, Swami has dilated quite a lot on Krishna's birth. And I think in different satsangs, we have also spoken about this part. Swami has also, you know, given a lot of emphasis on the devotion of the Gopikas, in particular Radha. Swami has written a drama entitled Radha Bhakti, titled as Radha Bhakti, in which he has composed the different poems and songs. So that is one aspect, the devotion of the Gopikas, or the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, you know, Swami has spoken so much on the Bhagavad Gita, and I believe there must be an entire summer course on the Bhagavad Gita. So,
right.
So there are these certain sections of or parts of Krishna's life on which Swami has emphasized over and over again, reiterated them and used them as examples in various discourses, in various fora, whether private or public. So we thought that it would be good to pick up one such theme, because today is Krishna Janmashtami, one such little recognized, yet a lot emphasized by Swami, one such theme, and that is Shri Krishna Raya Bharam.
Absolutely. You know, this is a very, very beautiful point, and it's a very profound episode in the life of Lord Shri Krishna. And when you're talking about the profundity of the events...
Yeah, before that, right, Raya Bharam meaning Krishna going as an emissary of peace.
Emissary of peace,
yes.
Right. So, we first have to talk about the war and some of those things. But before that, you know, what really stands out, especially when you're referring to an episode and saying that this is a very profound episode from the life of Shri Krishna, the beauty of the avatar itself, and when I say this without fail, I think all of us will be able to connect to the life of Swami, so effortlessly being profound and lighthearted at the same time. And that is something which Krishna did right through his life, you know, be it when he was a little child growing up in Vrindavan and Gokul, or in the later years when he would walk into these courts and, you know, would be able to give and advise people on dharma and the tenets of what is right and wrong. I mean, he did not have to shift from being one to the other. He could be both at the same time. Typically what we saw in Swami, you know, be it in the 1940s when Swami would, people would refer to Swami as Balasai, and so playful Swami was. At the same time, Swami was striking that fear and people had that respect for Swami. And same is the case, you know, when in the 2000s, because even now when I sit and recollect, when we all were students to Swami, Swami was probably 70. There was a difference of 50 years between us and Swami. But was there even a single day we felt that? That was because, you know, we really could relate to Swami. Swami was so playfully talking to us, and we could literally, you know, have the relationship of a friend. Why is Swami not talking to me? Why is Swami not doing this for me? And, you know, this is very bad of Swami. At the same time, if Swami was standing up and giving a discourse, as you said, you know, it becomes that scene of Bhagavad Gita where Swami is standing and you couldn't but give all your attention to Swami. And so effortlessly, so many incidents we can think of. I think we had that entire episode on Swami's humor, where we spoke of occasions when Swami was apparently playing a prank, and he was playing a prank, but would end it with a bang, with a very profound statement, which everybody could take home and think about for an entire lifetime. And that is why the life of Shri Krishna is so beautiful, and because of want of time, we are taking one episode and saying that this is so profound. But this also speaks about, will address a confusion that we have about the character of Lord Shri Krishna. And that's what's going to be the body of the satsang today.
And the thrilling thing is, when we decided that this should be a theme we should address, it was really beautiful and very touching that Swami gave us the perfect material. Because when we were going through the discourses that Swami delivered as part of the summer course held in Uti.
Right.
That is, I think, Summer Roses in the Blue Mountains. That was the title of the book. In that, it is either the fourth or fifth discourse, and the discourse itself, you know, the heading itself says, Krishna is a lover of peace and is not a warmonger, or something like that. So, dear listeners, it was very, very touching for us, because it felt as though it was a gentle nod of encouragement, a gentle prod of encouragement from Swami to us, saying that yes, this is what I want you to do. And that is why we have borrowed heavily from that discourse. In fact, in all of our satsangs, whether we explicitly state it or not, implicitly we are borrowing heavily from Swami's discourses, for we have no other source of our own. And so, from that discourse, we have been inspired by this topic of Shri Krishna Rayabharam, the peace mission that Krishna embarked on before the great war, at the great Bharatam war or the Mahabharata war, the war at Kurukshetra, before that took place, the peace mission that Krishna embarked on. And we also hope that in the course of our discussion, it will become very clear that Krishna was not the one who would incite and ignite war, as some instances and the way he is portrayed in some places show, that he is a person who likes to set fight between two people, and you know, he is like a warmonger. So that is not the case. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita, which is a treatise and it's a wonderful spiritual experience to go through, that itself is criticized by some, saying that, see, here was Arjuna saying, I don't want this. He had become a renunciant. He was ready to give up his kingdom. He was ready to, you know, give up his need for revenge. Everything he gave up, and he said, Krishna, let's just leave it. Let's just go and live in the, you know, I don't mind living a life of a renunciate in a forest. And they say at that time Krishna provoked him and said, no, you have to fight. So people often think that Krishna was the one who wanted the war. He was desperate to have the war. After all, that was his mission, right? He wanted to destroy the Kuru race. So there is a lot of misconception about Krishna being a warmonger. So we hope that this discussion clears that, because that is exactly what Swami has stated and proved also in this beautiful discourse that he delivered during the 1976 summer course.
Right. In fact, you're talking about the other people who thought like that. Even Dhritarashtra himself thought like that. That's one thing which he says, Sanjay, when he's narrating that scene of Krishna telling Arjuna that he needs to fight the battle. He's saying that, what's wrong with him? You know, here is Arjuna who's finally got some sense, and he's saying, let peace prevail. But Krishna is instigating him. And yeah, going to that discourse, the title of that discourse was, Krishna was always a lover of peace and never a warmonger. Mm. And it's typically, because, you know, when you look at it, it reminds me of an episode from the life of Mahatma Gandhi. I'm sure I've quoted this before. But it is typically how you need to address and approach the life of people as profound as an avatar. Because, you know, there is this person who comes up to Mahatma Gandhi and says that, you always say that I refer to the Bhagavad Gita to give me direction in life, right?
Hmm.
In the Bhagavad Gita, at the end of delivering the Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, oh, Arjuna, now you pick up your Gandiva and go and fight, right? Hmm. So the result of the Bhagavad Gita being transferred to Arjuna is, at the end of it, he goes and takes up to warfare, okay? And here you are, Mahatma Gandhi, you're saying that I refer to Bhagavad Gita all the time.
And do the opposite.
You're advocating non-violence, right? He said, how is it possible? Isn't there a contradiction there? So then Mahatma Gandhi gives a very beautiful reply, which I think we all have to keep in mind. He says that my direction does not come from the Bhagavad Gita. He says, I take the Bhagavad Gita inside and my direction now comes from inside. So he says, you cannot take directions directly from a book. It's not a manual. But it is something when you learn that, you know, you will find the insight to do what is right. And that is why when you look at the scenario of the war, you know, here is the Pandavas and the Kauravas, and Arjuna doesn't want to fight. Krishna comes and tells him, no, you have to fight. That is like giving the summary of the whole thing without understanding what is the essence behind this entire play which Krishna played. And that is where the problem lies. And that is what Swami says. In fact, another discourse which we put out, I think sometime last year, where Swami is talking about the different things which Krishna used to do, playing with the Gopikas and stealing butter and all of that. Mm. And he said how all of this can be misunderstood. And then Swami makes a beautiful statement there. If you want to understand the actions of an avatar, don't look at the actions of the avatar, but look within. He says when you look within, you will understand the actions of the avatar. And that is the thing which Swami wants us to do. In fact, in that discourse which you're referring to, Swami was inviting the students to do that. And Swami said, you don't do the mistake that people do when they look at the life of Krishna very casually.
You know, as you are saying this, just today morning, I happened to receive a link to a blog post. Okay. Actually, it's a very detailed post written by a person of no less eminence than, you know, Leonardo Guter.
Guter, okay.
I think he heads the South American continent.
Mm-hmm. Organization.
And he's been in Swami's organization for 4 decades. And this basically he is pouring his anguish along with logical statements as to how the fraud subtle Baba at Mudanahalli is violating everything that Swami stood for. So in that process, you know, when you were saying something that triggered, he has narrated one little episode that happened. You know, he said Swami once was very upset with him because he was delivering many speeches in Latin America. They were in Spanish. Okay. And somebody had transcribed all those speeches and made a book, and they said that we should get this published because it contains a lot of spirituality. So he said that though he did not want to do it, out of respect to the amount of effort that had gone in translation and transcribing and putting into a book form, he agreed to carry it to Prashanti. And one day he asked Swami, Swami, this is the thing. So then Swami said, Swami browsed through the book, he says, and Swami asked him, what is spirituality? Because these are all speeches on spirituality. So Swami asked him, what is spirituality? So he said, Swami, to go within for every answer. Then Swami said, no, that is not. You know, I am not remembering the exact words. Swami rubbished him and said, that is not. And he says, over the years, Swami has given him the answer directly as well as it has evolved. He says, to hear the voice of Lord within, you need not actually go within, because the voice is loud enough that you will hear. But to have the courage to follow that voice, you need to rid yourself of Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madamatsarya. Otherwise, they will distort and contort what voice is coming. Because, you know, as Swami says, even a thief has a conscience. It's not that only the men of God hear the voice of God. Everybody hears the voice of God. The difference comes in who puts it into practice. So he says that Swami taught him that spirituality is about removing all these defects. Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madamatsarya, which is anger, greed, envy, lust and all these, and purifying yourself completely so that you not only hear the voice of God, but you have the courage to put it into word and action. Because from what he realized, he says, you need not actually go inward to hear God's voice. God's voice is loud enough for us to hear. We don't have the courage to put it into our words and put it into our action because of all these. And actually, you know, I felt so thrilled because when we look at the battlefield of Kurukshetra, it's almost like that. You know, till Arjuna had traces of all these, Arjuna was irritated with the Kauravas. He wanted to fight, how many vows were taken? Bhima had said, I will drink your blood. All these things have happened. As long as all those were there, it's interesting that Krishna never allowed them an opportunity to attack the Kauravas. And interestingly, when Arjuna says that, you know, I don't want this, I don't want the kingdom, he has no desire left, he has no greed left, he has no hatred left, he has no enmity left, when nothing is left, then Krishna says, yeah, now you fight, you know. It's like now you have the courage to follow the voice of the conscience. It's simply amazing. It's simply amazing. And therefore, you know, if we actually go in detail, as Swami said, even in this discourse in 1976, Swami in the end says that you have to go into depth and understand it. And when you understand, you will see the beauty in each and every word that Krishna spoke and in each and every act that Krishna did.
And, you know, talking about it, it's not to overwhelm people. It's not like only if you have a level of purity and understanding, you will be able to decode what is told in these epics and in the life of these avatars. Because that reminds me of a very beautiful interaction which happened between a youth from Australia, I think, mm-hmm. and Swami. And mm-hmm. Swami had called them for a session in the bhajan hall. Mm-hmm. Swami said, if anybody has any questions, you can ask. And one of the youth asked this question, Swami, how do we know that we are getting purified? Now, we're doing bhajans, we're doing seva and all of this. How do we know that we are, in fact, getting purified? Okay. And Swami's answer was very crisp and straightforward. Swami said, you will start hearing the voice from within. Okay. And that was really a revelation for me, because as many people believe and as many people claim now, it is only the pure who can hear the voice. But Swami was not saying that. Swami said, when you start making the attempts, when you start even the first or second step towards purity, you will start hearing the voice inside. So this claim that, you know, there are only some people who can hear the voice because they are more pure than the others, I think it's a misunderstanding. Swami says that when you have the desire that I want to follow, because that's what happened to, this particular episode of Arjuna getting the message. You know, after 700 verses, he decided to follow. But when he decided that I would like to know, you know, consider me as your disciple and Krishna, become my guru and teach me. That is when he starts hearing the discourse, right?
Yeah, see, that is important thing, Prem. You know, it's like, what I'm hearing, is it a discourse or is it just sound? It becomes a discourse when I start making efforts, when I start to purify myself. That is what Swami said. Because otherwise it's always there. You know, I'm reminded of a little scene from an episode of Laurel and Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, Hardy, Oliver, who is this is a famous comedian of the yesteryears. So Hardy has received a letter from his fiancée. Basically, the letter is about how she wants to call off the engagement and she doesn't want to get married to him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Hardy is unable to find his glasses. So he tells Laurel that, can you please read out the letter to me? And Hardy is very excited to know what's there because it's from his fiancée. And so Laurel starts off, dear Oliver, and you know, Hardy is blushing and he's feeling very happy. And he starts reading out the whole letter about how, you know, things have been so good till now, but I don't think we can take this any further. With great regret, I would like to tell you that I don't want to get married, all this, so, and it's done. And he finishes that and he looks at Ollie, that is how he calls Hardy, that Ollie is looking very sad and downcast. So he says, what happened? He says, didn't you read it? And he says, yeah, I read it, but I wasn't listening, you know. So I feel that's what happens many times. We are sitting in Sai Kulwant Hall and we are hearing what Swami says, but we aren't listening. So in the same way, I think the voice of the conscience is constantly speaking to us. We are hearing it, but we are not listening. And that is probably what Mr. Guther understood by what Swami said, that it's not about hearing, because you can hear it. Everybody can hear the voice of God. Would you listen to the voice of God? To listen to the voice of God, you have to clear yourself of all these vices. And then only, as you start the process of clearing, you will realize that you have also started the process of listening.
And the other thing we hope that, you know, in this discussion, especially we invite all listeners to themselves go and read this discourse, as we mentioned, is one thing. You know, we are in a time of comparative religion. We always talk about comparing one religion to the other.
Mm.
What are the you know, thoughts in one religion which can be used for extremism? Is there in other religions? You know, when we talk about something like jihad in Islam, we talk about crusades in Christianity.
Dharma
Yudh.
Right,
in the same breath, we talk about Dharma Yudh and we say that, oh, Krishna instigated Arjuna to fight. I mean, you don't have to, you know, to sound sarvadharmic in that sense, put down all religion.
Hmm.
I think, you know, the mistake we do is we, I think, uniformly misunderstand all religions. That's what we are doing. What is important is, you know, as Swami would always say, when you look at somebody like Lord Krishna, in fact, even if you look at somebody like Swami, you cannot look at the act without observing the intention which inspired the act. And that is where the confusion will always come.
The intention, the time, the circumstances.
Exactly. And that is what is important. And, you know, when we look at Bhagavad Gita, the entire thing, as Swami would always say, the emphasis is on dharma. And when you talk about dharma for Arjuna, Arjuna is a kshatriya, who is a king, whose role was to, if necessary, take to arms and fight battles. So it's a completely different context altogether. And even that, we will come to see how that was given as the final option. You know, even though that he is a kshatriya, he is allowed to take arms, he is allowed to go and fight a battle. In fact, we should have done that in the Mahabharata. There is that section where all the kings sit together before the Mahabharata war and decide on the rules which will govern the war. And if you look at that, you will know that there is no comparison between that and what the kind of violence we see in the world today.
I remember some points, definitely, you know, Prem. Like, one of the rules is there is a categorization of warriors. You know, like Athirathi, Maharathi, Rathi.
Right.
Rathi is a person, basically Ratha is a chariot. And Rathi is a person who rides a chariot. Adhirathi is supposed to be a person who has a capacity to battle 100 chariots at the same time or something like that. 100, I don't know the exact number.
Or the number of people under their command, whichever way that categorization.
Yes,
is.
Because of your ability, you are given that many people under your command.
Right.
So you become an Adhirathi. Because you are much more skillful, much more talented, much more quicker than a Rathi in wielding the bow. And Similarly, there's a Maharathi who is grander than the Adhirathi, and it's possibly that a Maharathi can face 1,000 Rathis at one shot. He single-handedly can vanquish 1,000 Rathis or something like that. You know, that is how they are classified. And then they say in the beginning of the war itself that a Maharathi will face only a Maharathi. A Maharathi will not shower arrows on the Adhirathi. An Adhirathi will face only an Adhirathi.
Right.
A cluster of Adhirathis will face a Maharathi. A Rathi will face a Rathi. You know, it's like how we have in the Olympics. You don't have a flyweight or a bantamweight boxer fighting in the heavyweight category. In the same way, you don't have professional boxers coming in. You know, it's all as per the weight and class. So therefore, you see, there is no way you can compare this to the modern warfare. In the modern warfare on helpless, hapless citizens, you drop carpet bombs. You drop Scud missiles. You know, this is crazy. What is this? It's not like that. If we had to follow those rules today, it would be that a fighter aircraft will fight only a fighter aircraft of the same capability. Not like you use a stealth, high-powered, high-flying drone against a normal manned aircraft. It's not like that. It's each one to the other. That is the kind of dharma that was followed. So there is no way to compare the wars. And
in fact, you know, they say that one of the kings in the recent years, as we know historically, who followed many of these principles was Shivaji Maharaj. Some of the things he would say is no soldier should be the cause of death of a woman or a child. You know, a woman should not be even be touched in the scenario of a war. Crops should not be burnt, because that was something which many of the other kings used to do. They would go into a village or a town and burn the fields so that, you know, it would be the best way to attack economically a kingdom. So he would say that food should never be touched, food should never be burnt. The water source should not be poisoned. So all of these, they were followed. I mean,
and you know what? All the things that you're saying should not be done, these are the only modes of warfare that are being carried out. Right. You see on one hand, country A bombing country B with carpet bombs and scuds and harming the innocents. And country B is not having the economic power to fight country A. So country B resorts to poisoning the water source, cutting out the food and all these kind of... So there's no iota of dharmic war left in the world.
Right, and that is one thing, of course, the nature of the warfare itself. But even this warfare, which now when we look at it seems so docile in a sense, Krishna tells that when do you finally arrive at a situation where you say that, yes, we can go for a war. And I think that is what defines this debate itself, where Swami is saying, did Krishna stand for peace or did Krishna stand for war?
This theme is very close to my heart, Prem, because in our final year, as an offering to Swami, after the sports meet, during the cultural presentation time, we put up a drama on precisely this very theme, Shri right. Krishna Rayabaram. And having been part of the drama, it's such a beautiful ride down memory lane. And, you know, to start off on this theme as to how Krishna was the one wanting peace, at the end of the exile, when the Pandavas are now staking claim to their kingdom, saying that we have followed all the conditions that you had laid down. Though we knew that we were cheated in the game of dice, we agreed to play that game of dice. That was our fault. So as per that fault, we have already paid you in full by spending 13 years in exile and 1 year in Ajnatavasam, in hiding, so that we are not discovered.
Incognito,
yes. So 14 years have been complete. So now we want the kingdom back and our share of the kingdom. This is legal, this is moral, both. And without caring two hoots for legality and morality, the Kauravas just refused to give. At this point in time, you know, everybody's blood is boiling. Right from the mighty King Drupada, whose daughter Draupadi was almost molested publicly in the Kaurava court, to all the Pandavas who are just waiting to, you know, take the blood of the Kauravas, because it's not as if their exile was in peace. Even during the exile, the Kauravas kept launching some kind of a silent hidden attack or something or the other. They just could not see the Pandavas living in peace even without anything, you know. So all this 14 years of pent up anger, everything is there. And this is the point when they have all met, because this is something that is going illegal. So they have a right to take action. Nobody in history would have blamed them had they just picked up their weapons and attacked the Kaurava kingdom, and that is what they are planning to do. There is only one person who is apparently trying to play spoilsport, and who is that? Krishna. Krishna comes and says, no, this is not the time for battle, this is the time for peace. Rather than discuss it right away, I think we will play that one scene where all the kings and those who are favoring the Pandavas have gathered at Upaplavya, which is one of the main cities in King Virata's kingdom. And there they are discussing, and everyone you can see is wanting war, and how Krishna, beats each one of them in argument. This is a very quick scene. I think it was about 6 or 7 minutes in the drama, but this scene gives us a good idea as to what Krishna stands for.
Oh, warriors of matchless valor, all shastras and scriptures make it the obligation of every king to guide all mankind along the right path. Heed to the wise, teach the ignorant, guide the innocent and punish the wicked. Ensure dharma is upheld. If anyone resists its reign, hesitate not to draw his obedience through death.
It is in this injunction that the war with the Kauravas becomes our only resort to uphold dharma.
But O King of Panchala, the solution for a headache is not chopping the head. My heart shudders to heap horrors of death and pain upon humanity. I implore thee not to drown hearts in the wretchedness of a selfish revenge.
What selfishness is it to scathe those awful beasts that have slain dharma on the altars of greed and jealousy? Was it not their wretchedness that watched in shameless silence when my daughter was dishonored in the royal court? In the burning flames of their funeral pyres, I shall pour my agony and unburden my heart.
Then dress not your revenge in the guise of dharma. Mingle not your ire in the obligations of a king. Let not your emotions cloud your wisdom. O wise men, all doors to peace are not yet shut.
Madhusudana, it is not that we have not tried peace before. The head priest was sent as a messenger to convey that the terms of the exile had been served. But he was mocked and sent back.
Sanjaya too came from Hastinapura, and alas, the message of the king was, be wherever you are, and be at peace.
Patience is of no avail. No matter how hard you try, Duryodhana would not yield.
O Dhananjaya, it is not just about Duryodhana. Forget not noble men like Bhishma and Drona. They should certainly be given a chance.
Speak not of their nobility, O Krishna, that dissolves in shameless silence in the royal court.
O King of Virata, let not meanness of revenge and blindness of anger smite your soul. O men of noble birth, place your discrimination on the pedestal of brotherhood. Let us talk only of peace and not of war.
Krishna, we are no meek force to beg for peace time and again. Lances of Dharmaja have broken the bosoms of countless demons. The mace of Bhima, mightier than the Vajrayuda, shall deport thousands to the portals of death in a single sweep. The Gandhiva of Arjuna is a third eye of Mahadeva, spitting fire. The swords of Sahadeva and Nakula shall spell doom with every slice.
But history will not talk of your might, Vayunandana. It weighs you by your values. Your valor is but a curse on humanity if it cannot usher peace to your fellow. Go, go fan the storms of hatred and ravage the world and let history mock. Oh, how supremely foolish art thou, men. Thou sold your souls to the wily anger's lust.
Oh, Krishna, what about my daughter's untied hair?
Is a droplet of blood on your daughter's hair far worthier than tears of countless mothers, O King. Transcend your petty selves and weigh them on the scales of greater good. Where hath all your compassion gone, O Nakula? Let not the words spoken in mindless rage be foolish bindings on your actions. What is your opinion, O Dharmaja?
O Krishna, we know not what to do. Smitten by failure and haunted by misery, confused we stand. Lead us, O Lord, for you alone know what is right. We surrender to thee.
So we unanimously decide to be patient and make one last attempt for peace. Let me visit the royal court of Hastinapur. I shall be your messenger of peace.
You know, when we were writing the script, it was very difficult because so many dialogues are packed in this episode actually. If we look at the original Mahabharata, to write this episode would have taken almost half an hour of the drama time itself. We couldn't do a whole drama just on this, as to how brilliantly Krishna debates and counters each argument. And there is nothing you can tell to Krishna that's right, because Krishna is right. And that dialogue in the end that Krishna says, you know, it's very ironical actually, if you see, because Krishna says that we unanimously decide to give peace another chance. It looks, you as I said, it looks ironic because we didn't have enough time, you know. If we are able to develop, we try to summarize an entire conversation into two dialogues, one dialogue by the person and Krishna's rebuttal to it. That's it. That actually takes place as a conversation lasting almost 3-4 minutes. So if we listen to that, then we come to know that it's actually a unanimous decision. Everybody agrees that yes, we should give peace an opportunity. And but somehow, yeah, as we had a time constraint and we did it only in 6-7 minutes, the whole scene, it suddenly looks like, hey, what is this? What is unanimous in this? But it was a unanimous decision, and that is how Krishna convinces. You know, at the beginning, everybody wants war and is seeking war. It's like they're shouting, war, 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 war. And Krishna comes and he's not shouting against them or with them. He calmly asks questions to each of them and just shows each one what they're wanting. He shows to one person that you're not wanting to fight for dharma, but you want revenge. You are fighting not for dharma, but for anger. You are fighting not for dharma, but for passion. You know, to each one he shows that you are camouflaging your own inner bestial nature with the garb of dharma and justifying the war. And once each one sees it, see, that's also a tribute to the greatness of the people there. Because when they saw the error, they recognized it, and therefore they unanimously agreed for peace. So when we see this, we realize that Krishna absolutely was the one, in fact the only one, who was batting for peace at this point in time.
You know, when you observe let's say evil people, here Kauravas are the evil ones. What will be the approach of evil people? They will only look at two things. What is it that I want? And do I have the power to grab it? Right? That's all matters to them. Yeah, I want this, and the person who's having it is weaker than me, so I can grab it from them. So as a counter to that, from the scene, what is the approach of these people in the Pandava camp? He said, are we right? Yes, we are right. Do we have the power to stamp our authority over what is really us? Yes, we have it. So why not let's exercise it? You know, that is the approach. But what Krishna is bringing here is a very, very important thing which all of us have to remember. Many times in life, we may be right. Right? And we might have the authority and probably, you know, we might have a legal recourse, or we might have the, you know, we think that we have the moral authority to go and shout at that person or get our things done. But what Krishna is asking is, if you're a good person, you also have to consider what will be the impact of your action on people around you. You know, only a good person will consider that. One who's evil will only, as I said, think of only two things. Do I want it? Do I have the power to grab it? But it's a good person's moral obligation to think, that I might have the moral authority to go and seek what I want or punish the person who is wrong, who is doing wrong to me, but will that in any way affect people who are innocent? It is very important for a person who is on the side of the right to even consider that.
That's really a very, very powerful message, because we often think that, like you said, yeah, it's evil to desire something and see if you have the power to get it, and spare no means in order to get it. That's wrong. Get it at any cost. That's wrong. So we think the opposite of that is, first see whether it's right or not. If it is right, and if you have the power, yes, go ahead. In fact, it is considered nobler that even if you don't have the power, just because it's right, you go ahead.
Right.
You know, but because it is right, you're going ahead with it. So you become a martyr if you lose yourself or you lose anything of yours in the process. But here is one more point that is being brought about, that even though you're right, even though you have the might, you're still ready to look beyond yourself, look at how it affects others. And if it is going to negatively affect others, you are ready to even sacrifice, you know, what you think is the only way to achieve that, right? See, that is another thing. It's not as if Krishna said that, see, it's going to lead to a lot of bloodshed, so let's forget about it. No. You look at other options. He said, exactly. I will go as a peace messenger. It's not that you stop doing right because it's going to cause hurt to many. It's not that. If you have to do right, always, that is no negotiation on that. You have to do right, but using might and smashing is not the first option. Let that be the last option. Try everything else. Swami says, if you can't oblige, also speak obligingly. That is the amount of emphasis Swami placed on keeping everyone happy and helping ever. If you can't help, at least hurt never. Not hurting anyone. So therefore, Krishna is not telling them, let's not do what is right. Krishna is telling, yes, we definitely have to do what is right, but let not war be the first option. We put aside war so much so that Krishna even doesn't want to encourage the thoughts of war. Why to make war the last option only in theory? When you know that at the end, you know, we are anyway going to fight the war, so simply we'll just place it in the end so that we can rule out other options. Not like that. We sincerely make attempts for other options. Let's try peace. Let's just forgive them for all the injustice we have suffered. Let's be bigger over here, forgive them. And if they're ready for peace, let's live happily from now on. It's in everybody's benefit. You know, this is the kind of beautiful, noble thinking that only the Lord is capable of, or one who is immersed in the Lord is capable of.
When we were kids, we've had this. There used to be many series of jokes. You know, a doctor's joke, knock-knock joke like that. We used to have one series, the ant and the elephant joke. Very, very absurd jokes. One joke I remember in that is, you know, there's an ant which stops an elephant which is walking by, and he says, I've come to confront you because you stamped over me last week. But you know what? I've decided to forgive you. You can go ahead.
You know, what ant forgive?
Right? You know, that's one thing. What Krishna is saying is, yes, Arjuna single-handedly can defeat the entire Pandavas. Yes, Bhima can...
Kauravas.
Yes. You know, Bhima can single-handedly vanquish the entire Kaurava army. You have the power to do that, but having that power, can you forgive? You know, a person who is weak will always be ready to forgive.
It's nothing great if the ant forgives the elephant, but exactly. If the elephant forgives the ant.
To forgive the ant. And, you know, that is what Krishna is saying here. Nobody is saying that you don't have the ability to win the war, if there is one. But having that ability, be completely convinced that yes, you can win it, but still are you thinking of the other options, and as you said, not consider war as an option at all. That is where magnanimity really shines.
And you know, after this, as Krishna decides, he goes. In fact, I think Krishna is the second attempt, you know. Before this, one of the dialogues in the drama showed that. I think Sahadeva speaks that. He speaks about how a priest was sent. A priest is actually sent,
right,
for a peace proposal.
Priest.
So you see, it becomes even more beautiful because it's not as if they haven't tried. We have tried peace, it didn't work. And now Krishna is saying, no, you tried peace, but let me try it. Because everybody recognizes Krishna as the ultimate, he's the best. And, you know, Krishna is a person against whom both sides don't have anything. For instance, both Duryodhana and Arjuna go to seek help from Krishna in case of a war. They want, you know, this is what kingdoms of yore would do, that if they will forge alliances, and more usually than not, they would forge these alliances through marriage.
Right.
Give your daughter in marriage to the son of the next kingdom. Give your son in marriage to the daughter of the other kingdom. So that now, by marriage, you three kingdoms become one kingdom. So, you know, you forge alliances. And Yadavas are a very, very powerful name. Very, very powerful kingdom, clan. And both Duryodhana, both the Kauravas and the Pandavas want to ensure that Krishna will support them. And that's another beautiful story in itself with so many messages where, you know, I'm tempted to just quickly narrate it, where both Arjuna and Krishna, Duryodhana land up in Krishna's chambers to seek his help. And though Duryodhana is the one who has come first, Krishna asks Arjuna what he wants first, because he says, when I opened my eyes, I saw Arjuna first. And why did he see Arjuna first? Because Arjuna was standing at the Lord's feet, while Duryodhana felt it below his dignity and he's sitting beside the Lord's head. So you see, there itself is the message that humility always takes you further than what arrogance can take you. So there Krishna puts a proposition. He says, both are seeking help and both are against each other. I'll have to help both because both of you are same to me in terms of the relation. So therefore, here is my offer. On one side is my entire army, all my forces. On the other side is me. And that too, not just me. I'll be unarmed. I will not pick up arms. It's not as if you've got Krishna, the great warrior. You've just got Krishna. He won't battle also. But the first choice will be Arjuna's. You know, at that time, Duryodhana feels it's unfair because, you know, Arjuna is getting the first choice. He fights for the first choice. Krishna says, no, Duryodhana, I saw him first. He's also younger than you in age. So it's only natural that Arjuna gets the first choice. And Arjuna says, Krishna, I want you. And Duryodhana is jubilant because he says, wow, this is great. It's like, you know, in cricket, if you have decided to bat first when you win the toss, you don't mind winning the losing the toss as long as your opponent captain wants to bowl first when he wins the toss. It is win-win for you. And that is how Duryodhana feels. He feels great. Oh, this is what I wanted, the army. So Krishna has decided, you know, even at that point in time, Krishna has decided that even if it comes to the war, I will not be fighting. You know, what greater, commitment towards peace do you need from Krishna? Because even if the war were to actually happen, Krishna has promised that I will be unarmed. I will not take up arms against anyone. See, the Lord, whether he takes on the human avatar or the Lord remains as the Supreme Lord in the skies above, he's always the witness. He's always the witness. Whatever good or bad that we face in our life, we are to blame ourselves. We should never blame God, because God is the witness. And even when he comes as the avatar, that is what he chooses to do. He says that I will not participate in the war. I will just be unarmed. That is the kind of commitment that Krishna has towards peace. And therefore, both the families respect and revere Krishna. And Krishna therefore says, let me take up another peace proposal. That shows that he is ready to take that extra step towards peace. Because they have already tried one peace proposal which has flopped. Krishna says, no, we'll try a second peace proposal, because when it comes to innocent blood, let's not spare any effort to prevent that innocent blood from being shed.
Right, and that is how this entire episode comes to be, which is called the Krishna Rayabharam, where Krishna goes as the peace emissary of the Pandavas. And as you said, you know, he is a personality who is equally respected by both. You know, respect is a common thing when you come across somebody who is of a great stature. But love is a different thing and fear is a different thing. You know, you can have respect plus fear, you can have respect plus love. And I think that's precisely what differentiated both the camps.
Respect because of love, respect right. Because of fear.
Because on the Kaurava army, Kaurava side, when they came to know that Krishna is coming as the peace emissary, they knew, you know, what all Krishna is capable of. And they decided to put their best, you know, face forward, because they decided that they will give him such a royal welcome and such a respectful welcome into the kingdom that Krishna will feel obliged, because they've already done that to one person. One noble person is already bowled over by that.
Karna, that is Shalya.
Karna is in their camp.
And even Shalya.
Shalya, right? That's how they pull him also to their ranks.
Yeah, just quickly recapping, you know what happens? Shalya is the Matsya Raja, I think. He has decided to support the Pandavas
right.
in the war. And so he's going to meet the Pandavas. Along the way, he sees the hospitality and he enjoys the hospitality of what he thinks is the Pandavas' hospitality. It is actually a Kaurava camp that has interestingly been put on his path to the Pandava kingdom. They have gone out of their way to set up hospitality to make him indebted. You know, in Hindi we have a phrase called Namak Haram.
Right.
Namak Haram is one who cheats the person whose salt he has had. So it is said that when you dine in somebody's home, you can't cheat them, you can't betray them, you can't go against them because they have fed you. You have eaten his salt. That's how the term comes. Namak is salt and haram is to cheat. Namak haram, they say. So, the opposite term is, I think, namak halal, where you are, you know, you are obligated simply because you have had his food. That's what happens. Though Shalya knows that the Pandavas are right and he wants to back them, simply because he has this obligation to honor, he finally ends up fighting on the side of the Kauravas later in the war.
Right. And because God has his ways of using even that to your disadvantage if you are, you know, doing it with the wrong intention. But that's a different story altogether. But that's what they're trying to do here, because they're seeing that we'll give him such an inordinate welcome, which is not appropriate really for a messenger, because even though Krishna is what he is, he's coming as a messenger from the enemy camp.
Hmm.
You know, there is a certain lot of rules about how you treat a king who's coming to your kingdom. How do you treat a messenger of a king who comes to your kingdom? How do you treat a Brahmin who comes to your kingdom? So in that sense, Krishna is only coming as a peace emissary, and he does not really call for that kind of a reception, but he's given one to kind of floor him and, you know, feel indebted to the Kauravas. But there's another very beautiful episode which happens apparently when Krishna comes first time to the Kaurava kingdom.
Hmm.
I think he comes along with Pandavas and Draupadi when she comes for the first time.
Hmm.
And I remember listening to this in one of the talks which I think was given in Swami's presence, where even then Duryodhana decides that, you know, some way we have to keep this fellow under our control.
Hmm.
So let us take him around, and he calls Dushasana and tells, you take Krishna around the kingdom and show him the different places. And different places means different palaces. 100 princes, and each one of them had a huge palace to
of
their
own.
You know, of their own. So here is Dushasana taking Krishna on a chariot along with Vidura, who was the, you know, minister of the Kaurava kingdom. And he was showing all these huge palaces. He said, this is Duryodhana's, this is mine, and this is uncle's, and this is so-and-so's and so-and-so's. Each one of them better than the other. Okay, so Krishna is looking at it apparently in awe. Then in the midst of all this opulence, there is this very humble dwelling, a very simple house. And Krishna looks at it and says, hey, this is weird. You know, whose place is this? Whose house is this? And there is Vidura in the same chariot. He very, very beautiful episode. You know, he puts his hands together and he bows down to Krishna and says, Krishna, it is yours. It's apparently Krishna, Vidura's house. He doesn't say it is mine. He says, Krishna, it is yours. So then Krishna says, oh, I didn't know that I have a house even in Hastinapura. So he says, henceforth, whenever I come here, I will stay in my house. Right? And that's exactly what Krishna says when he comes here. When he is offered the best palace to live in, Krishna says, first of all, I come as a peace emissary, so it is not right on my part to indulge in your hospitality even before my task is completed. And secondly, he says that, you know, here is Vidura's house, and I will, as always, stay only in Vidura's house. And that's how he decides to stay in Vidura's house before he meets the king in the court.
Actually, there also, you know, there's a lot of exchange that happens where, you know, it shows how crystal clear are Krishna's thoughts. Mama Shri Shakuni is there, whom Duryodhana considers as the metal for Krishna. They think that Krishna is the advisor for the Pandavas, just like, and in order to match Krishna, we have Shakuni. And the only difference between the Krishna and Shakuni is dharma and adharma, that's all. Because in terms of their skill, in terms of their ability, in terms of their thinking, in terms of their intellectual capacity, yeah, Shakuni is amazing. In fact, he's the one who has planned this whole thing of sending the Pandavas away. But as I said, at the biggest point, the difference comes. That is between dharma and adharma. So therefore, though you may appreciate Shakuni for his intelligence, his amount of study he has gone, the knowledge of history that he has, everything is amazing, and yet we see people don't admire Shakuni today simply because he was on the path of adharma. And I think that should be a message for all of us Shakunis who grow, in the sense, in irrespective of what our skills, talents and abilities might be, if we tread the path of injustice and adharma, however secretly we do it, in the end, none of our skills, abilities or anything is ever going to matter. It will only be a thing that will bring us to greater shame. So here Shakuni actually tells Krishna, Krishna, see, you have come as a peace messenger. Peace messenger meaning you are interested only in peace and you are not interested in either of the parties.
Right.
So how does it matter if you take, if you become our guest? How does it matter? Because you are not related to either side. He says, no, I am not related to either side. But any side that seeks me, I am more attached to that side. Then Shakuni says, then yeah, we also seek you as desperately as the Pandavas sought you. Krishna says, I don't think that is the case. Why? Because when there was a choice, Duryodhana chose my army over me. And there Shakuni doesn't let go. He says, no, but Duryodhana didn't choose you. It was Arjuna who chose you.
Mm-hmm.
And the option, the choice was already made.
Right.
And therefore Duryodhana had to settle for second thing. So Krishna says, because Duryodhana wants the kingdom, see how he is fighting. Couldn't he have spoken at least one word of protest to Arjuna? Saying that, no Arjuna, it's unfair, I also want Krishna. Which means, at least from this, you don't want me as much as you want the kingdom. Straight. That's it. Right? You didn't even protest. I agree that Arjuna got the first choice, but you didn't even protest. You could have protested. What prevented you from protesting? And he says, now that Arjuna has wanted me, so therefore I am towards Arjuna. Since you are an enemy to Arjuna, it will not be right on my part to dine here. You know, it's so beautiful, so crystal clear, the thinking process, and he exposes the hypocrisy and the kind of injustice that the Kauravas are doing. And then, as you said, he goes to Vidura's house. What happens in Vidura's house, though may not be directly related to Krishna being a emissary of peace and not a warmonger, I think we should go into that beautiful episode. But before doing that, I think, Prem, we will play out one more clip from the same drama. An episode where the Kauravas are meeting before actually Krishna, you know, comes and places his proposal in the court. They are planning on what they should do when Krishna is in court and putting up proposals which they feel will be on behalf of the Pandavas. This scene is important because, you know, it shows that the Kauravas have decided that they don't want this peace. They are going to shun this proposal. It becomes very evident. And I'm sure that if this was the mindset and it was evident to the Pandavas, it would be evident even to Krishna. It is yet another tribute to Krishna that in spite of knowing this, he is ready to take up and put in that effort for peace. Because this scene makes it amply clear that the one who decides among the Kauravas, which is Duryodhana, he definitely does not want peace. But I also feel that this scene has some more beautiful elements. It shows the feelings that are going on in the different people in the Kaurava camp. This is a scene that involves Dhritarashtra, the king, his son Duryodhana, there is Shakuni, there is Dushasana, the brother, then there is Bhishma, there is Kripacharya and Dronacharya, all of them who want actually peace because they are all righteous by nature. I think we'll play the scene and enjoy it.
Hastinapur Samrat Maharaj Dhritarashtra, Ganga Putra Bhishma, Mahamantri Vidur aur Acharya Dron Padhar Rahe Hain.
O King, Vasudeva has finally arrived in an attempt to avert the war. Listen to his voice in solemnity and reverence and pay heed to his advice. He epitomizes the eternal truth, and so it is no ordinary event that he himself has come. Weigh his proposal upon the scales of wisdom and find its worth therein.
Maharaj, Krishna's visit is not a mere attempt for peace. Beyond the compassion of his looks and the sweetness of his smile, there is a righteous anger that is waiting to be unleashed. O King, save Hastinapura from the wrath of the Pandavas led by Krishna.
Do not squeal such weak words, Kaka Shri. The rage of Pitama, the skill of Acharya, the bow of Karna and Suyodhana's mace shall embarrass the Pandavas into mortified muteness. And Mama Shri's brilliance shall put to shame even Krishna's acumen.
My son, war is not a game of dice. Your words are but hollow echoes and shameful shadows of a loathsome pride. Let not your greed dig countless graves. Let not wild ambition ascend the throne that legitimately belongs to wisdom.
Acharya! Attempt not to beckon slavery from our fierce hearts. War is the only solution for a Kshatriya.
Children, your hearts are goblets of gold. But alas, you have chosen to savor the wine of greed and toss the goblet by. Maharaj, pay heed to my words and give away Indraprastha to the Pandavas.
But Indraprastha is under Suyodhana's control. I have no say in this matter.
Your power was a free-flying bird, but you chose to lock it in a cage and give the silver key to your son. Fie upon his ambitious greed and pride. But it is not too late. Stretch and see Krishna's offer, my son.
My ears have been longing to sip that word, son, from your lips, father.
Maharaj, we are deliberating on an entirely different issue right now.
But father, I have done all that I could to please Krishna. I have arranged the best of palaces for his stay, assigned 1,000 servants to attend to his every need, and ordained 18 golden chariots at his disposal.
Maharaj, Krishna cannot be bought by material wealth. Seek not to bribe him, my lord.
I have not seen in the clan of Kuru servants reprimanding their masters, ministers admonishing their kings.
O king of Gandhara, it is the duty of the minister to speak the truth. The day he justifies the follies of his master, be assured that the kingdom is doomed. Maharaj, you may not listen to me, but I am bound to you, my lord, and I will speak only the truth, however harsh it may seem to your ears.
What is all this argument for? Why do you all blame Suyodhana for his greed? It was the Pandavas who lost the kingdom in the game of dice.
Let not the attachment for your son overpower your responsibilities. Take pity on the fate of Hastinapura. For a moment, be a king, Maharaj. Be a king and not a father.
Maharaj, with Krishna on their side, the Pandavas shall march to victory.
You are right, Acharya. Let us not incense Krishna by giving scope to insult. Say, how do we welcome Krishna into the royal court? Will he be given a seat next to me? Or can we seat him next to Gangaputra Bhishma?
The seating arrangement is not a solution to the war, Maharaj. Krishna is beyond honor or insult. He stands for Dharma, and Dharma is on Pandava's side. It is their immaculate character that binds him to them.
Mahatma Vidura, does that mean that Suyodhana is of despicable character? And so he cannot rule as the emperor of Hastinapur?
I have heard enough of this nonsense. As they have found Krishna with their so-called love, I too shall find him with my power. I shall make him my prisoner.
Bridle your tongue to the channel of your hateful throat, you foolish brat, else ruin shall seize thee. Then neither Bhishma nor Drona
Not even Brahma can save your soul from Krishna's ire. Maharaj, for the foolishness of your son, you will not have a droplet of tear to wet his ghastly corpse.
Wow, you know, Prem, it is so difficult to remain non-emotional for me because it takes me back to those beautiful times when, you know, we were putting up this drama in Swami's presence. It was so beautiful in so many ways, Prem, and I know it's a digression, but please, because I'm being pulled into it emotionally, allow me to go into that. I'll narrate just one or two little things that happened, you know. On the day of the drama itself, we had one very difficult proposition here. You know what happens, right? When he goes to the court, finally Krishna gives darshan as the Vishwa Virata Swarupa. He gives his darshan as the Virata Rupa. And we were wondering, how do we present this Vishwarupa in Sai Kulwant Hall? Now, originally the drama was planned to be put only in the Institute Auditorium. So we had planned for a huge screen and we were going to project a Vishwarupa of Lord Krishna. 3 days before the drama could be staged, we got the message that the drama had to be staged in Kulwant Hall. And now we didn't have it, this was in the year 2007, we didn't have a projector that would be bright enough that could project Vishwarupa in Kulwant Hall. So we were at our wit's end as to what do we do, because we felt that the whole drama was moving towards this Vishwarupa, and if Vishwarupa is, that is a grand climax for us, and what do we do? You know, one day before the drama, we got this idea of when Duryodhana orders for Krishna to be seized, we thought, we suddenly have a dozen of Krishna in the court. Because, you know, Swami finally says, Vishwarupa doesn't mean the Lord has 1,000 heads. It means that all the heads that you see around you are belonging to the Lord. And 1,000 hands doesn't mean Lord has 1,000 hands. It means that all the hands that you see around you are the Lord's. So seeing the Lord in creation is the Vishwarupa Darshan. That's how Swami has given the inner meaning of Vishwarupa. So we thought we will go to take a midway solution. So basically, Duryodhana starts seeing his soldiers as Krishna. He sees everybody as Krishna there in the court. And all these Krishnas, you know, one dozen of them come and make a kind of formation. Right. One behind the other. So that from Swami's point of view, when you look straight, you can see that one Krishna has dozens of hands and so many heads. That was the idea we came up with. And we were so thrilled. And in this thrill, you know, we had all gathered in the bhajan hall before the drama. And some of us were very excited at this solution that we had come up with, because it looked like we had no chance of showing Vishwarupa, and finally this brilliant idea, and it was looking very good when we practiced it.
Mm-hmm.
So, when Swami came and he was speaking about the drama, you know, we got up and told Swami, Swami, would you like to see Vishwarupa Darshan? Swami said, you will show me Vishwarupa Darshan? And you know, we didn't get the question that Swami asking. We said, yes Swami, if you want to see, you tell, we will show you. You know, it was such a beautiful moment, because later on it was almost like Swami is saying that when time comes, I will show you the Vishwarupa Darshan. But we did this, we showed Swami how it was, and Swami was looking at it. The amazing thing is the way Swami's focus is in the bhajan hall when this Vishwarupa Darshan was displayed. So many of the other teachers and people who were there in the bhajan hall, they too had not seen this. So they were really bowled over by how amazing it was looking. But you know, when we looked at Swami's face, he was not at all, he was not at all showing any sign of being impressed or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he just said, hey, see that fourth Krishna there in the Vishwarupa Darshan. That fellow's dhoti is a little high, you pull it a little down. And you know, I was sitting in front and I was really disappointed. I said, Swami, this is such a grand, beautiful thing is being shown, and this is where your focus goes. You know, this is what I was thinking, you know, but as we discussed last time, desha kala paristhiti, there's a time, there's a place for everything. Swami didn't appear appreciative here. But you know, when actually we were portraying the drama, just before this scene of the Virata Swarupa, you know, Swami went inside the interview room and he sent a message saying, tell them to wait, let them not proceed with the drama. So So we paused the CD, we were waiting, and the boys who were accompanying Swami told us that Swami said, the Vishwarupa Darshan they have worked for, it is very beautiful, it is very grand. With the lighting it will come more grand, now it is still bright outside. Let me sit inside, it will become a little dark, then with the lighting it will come out so beautifully. You know, when we got to hear this, even now as I recollect, I get goosebumps on my skin. See, we think that Swami is not appreciating our efforts, but Swami knows when to appreciate, how to appreciate in a manner that gives the maximum joy and benefit. And when he came out, and when the Vishwarupa was done, of course it appeared stunning. And the way Swami appreciated, Swami was so happy, it brought so much of thrill to us. So you see, the same Swami who didn't even apparently bat an eyelid while watching this, because that was the time for seeking perfection. You know, pull the dhoti down. In fact, he also told Krishna, he said, who painted your face blue like this? He said, Swami, Krishna was blue. Swami said, not this blue. This is so dark. No, this is not, no, none of the Gopikas will look at your face, Swami told him, you know. And he was taken back and, you know, the correct shade of blue was brought. And when he went to offer the rose, Krishna went to offer the rose to Swami before the drama began, Swami said, ah, now all the Gopikas will come behind you. You know, it was so beautiful. So you see, backstage, he's a perfectionist. And then when actually the drama is going on, he's the perfect audience. So, you know, this is how we have seen Swami. We get to know how the Lord is. That is how Krishna is also. When the actual thing comes that there is nothing else that can be done but the war has to be fought, yes, Krishna only encourages and fights the war. But till then, he performs the role of a messenger of peace to perfection.
I mean, many times when you know Swami talks about especially the avatars' actions, we don't know about the other avatars. But I can tell personally, and I'm sure many other devotees who've spent time with Swami will also vouch for this fact, that we have misunderstood Swami innumerable number of times. And the one reason when we come out of that misunderstanding, there would be a time when after that event passes, we look back and then with hindsight and wisdom, we find that we were actually wrong, we misunderstood Swami, just like a small incident that you narrated. Most often when we look back and we find that, oh, we misunderstood Swami, what was the cause for that misunderstanding? It's because we were so self-centered, or, you know, we were thinking about our needs,
our desires.
As you're saying that, you know, when you're showing that scene to Swami, you wanted that pat of appreciation so much. Because we were focusing on our efforts. So many times it's happened. You know, when we're thinking about Swami, how much devotion I have for you, and you don't respond to it. How much I have done for you, and you not respond to it. The thing which is really lacking is, it's that devotion which is lacking. And when we don't look at Swami and Swami's actions and Swami's words bereft of the devotion, when we look at Swami's thing bereft of the devotion, I think that's when we misunderstand. And that's what Swami would always say, that when you read the words of the scriptures, when you read the words of Swami, when you read a discourse, the first and foremost thing which is required is that Shraddha and devotion with which you have to read it. You have to be convinced that what Swami says is definitely good, what Swami says is definitely right. If it is not appearing so, then there is something wrong in the way I am approaching the theme.
Or the way I am understanding
right.
it.
Right. And that's precisely with the avatar of Krishna. If anybody says that Krishna stood for war and Krishna wanted the war to be there, I think there's something which we are getting wrong. Because Swami says one of the most important things about spirituality is, Swami says, help ever, hurt never. There should be no person who should be harmed by your words, deeds or even presence. And you know, Swami would beautifully say that there is no better definition of culture than by saying that culture is concern for others. So you can't, you know, how do you reconcile with this fact that here is Krishna who is wanting the Pandavas to go for war, if that is the idea that we have, and this idea that Swami says that one should always have concern for others? Then there is somewhere we are missing the bigger picture, and that is what Swami is really inviting us to see by going through all this, you know, what all Krishna did to avoid war. And that is really, you know, the character of Krishna.
You know, Prem, actually, though we took up this theme for this week, we still have got several points, and I feel that it is logical that we spill this over to the next week as well, so that we can complete this discussion. Next week we can take up from where we have left off now, that is how Krishna goes to Vidura's house and what happens. We shall also discuss a little more in detail as to the mindsets of the different people, that is Bhishma, Drona and Duryodhana, that they are there. But you know, on the point that you said about misunderstanding God, in the discourse that we are referring to, as I said, the fourth or fifth in the series Summer Roses on the Blue Mountains, 1976. In that discourse towards the end, Swami gives an example. He says, see, there is a very young boy who gets married to a young girl, and unfortunately the young boy dies. He dies young, and the woman decides, in her loyalty, the girl actually, she's a young girl, she decides to remain like that without marrying throughout her life. In those days, marriages at a young age were very common. So, Swami says that this girl grows older and she becomes a 70-year-old woman after several decades. And she has retained the photo of her husband, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody looks at that photo and asks, who is this person? She says, that's my husband. And Swami says that immediately people think that, look at this, what is this woman doing, you know, she is so old, a 70-year-old is marrying a teenage boy, how wrong it is. But Swami says that this is the way you are judging even Krishna. You judge in a hurry, you judge based on current circumstances. He says, in order to understand how this woman and that young boy would have been a couple, you have to travel 6 decades back in time and then picture them. So too Swami says, you have to travel back to the times in which Krishna was staying and see the situation, see the all the three things, you know, desha, kala, paristhiti, and then understand. But in order to do that, you must have interest, right? This is not what Swami is saying, but I'm saying we must have interest. Only if we are keenly interested will we want to go in depth and understand. And only when we go into depth will we be able to understand the beauty of any avatar. Therefore, you know, whether we are studying Krishna or Swami or anybody, we can't do it with one cursory look at a book or cursory glance at something or just hear two people and form. We have to dive deep ourselves and gather the pearls on our own to appreciate the treasure that each avatar is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll definitely push over the discussion to next week. Dear listeners, we'll conclude our episode here, but not before playing for you our Radio Sai special for Janmashtami. And this is, again, a very beautiful composition, which is called the Balamukunda Stotram. You know, we've heard it many times, but the attitude with which this stotram was composed itself is very, very beautiful. And we're just reading about it. They say that what are the best ways in which you can approach the Lord in devotion? You know, we've seen many, we're going to the Navida Bhakti, we've seen the many ways in that. But the author of this stotram says that the best way is to look at God as a child. Because he says when a mother loves the child, sometimes the child is not even able to respond to that love. Mm. Because the child is in its own mood. Sometimes it's happy, sometimes it's unhappy. You don't have even that intelligence in front of you that will respond and appreciate the love that you're giving. But still the mother loves. That is because it's an expression and there is no give and take in that.
No expectation.
Right. There's absolutely no expectation. And he says that is the best way to love the Lord also. So can you look at the Lord as a baby, as, you know, that Vatapatra Sai, they would say, you know, one of the forms of Lord Krishna, lying on the on a banyan leaf and sucking his own toe.
Uh-huh.
Right. And he says, can you look at the Lord as that baby which is so innocent and which probably is not even in a state to acknowledge the love that is coming forth from you, and can you love the Lord like that? And this stotram was literally composed with that idea. So all the descriptions and all the paragraphs are referring to Lord Krishna as that little child. So dear listeners, we'll play for you this song. It's been sung by our own Ashwat Narayan and has been arranged by our Anirudh, Ashwat's brother. So we'll play that for you. For the lyrics and the meaning, you can go to the Radio Sai website. You'll find both of that there. With the song, we'll conclude this episode. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu for his program. Do join us again next week for the conclusion of this satsang. Thank you.
Bye.
ಇತ್ತು.